Today is September 15th, 2008, and we are at the Amelia Island Museum of History at 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Helene Scott. She was born April 6, 1922, in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My name is Bobby Faust, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. Helene, why don't we start by talking about where you were when World War II broke out and what you were doing.
World War II, December 7th, 1941, I was working. I graduated high school, Haynes High School in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in January that year. And I took that course called Distributive Educations, and I think it just started the year before, which meant if you're in high school, if you wanted to take the DE course, then you could get out of the school half a day. So I took the course because you could get a job locally, and you were judged and graded by your owner or manager that where you worked.
Huh.
So I got, and that was the first year DE went into effect. I remember that, and I've checked it out since. And it's still going in high schools.
Wow.
DE. So anyway, I took a job at Coyne's Dress Shop, which is a fashionable dress shop in Winston-Salem. And he catered to preteens and fashionable name brand merchandise in those days. And he did personal shopping for the wealthy people in town. And in those days, you could send fashions out on approval for the lovely ladies to try on. And if they liked them, they would keep them. If not, we would pick them up. That kind of thing. It was a good catering fashion business. Anyway, I got a job there, and I loved it. And I worked after school every day. You know, I worked half a day, you know, before I took DE, I had applied for that job, however, and there was no opening. But after DE, with that influence, Mrs. Foster got me the job. So anyway, I was happy doing that. And when the war broke out, and of course that summer after I graduated, I worked there every day. And I made like something like a whole $32 a week, which in those days, it's like maybe $200 today. You know, that's a lot of money. So anyway, I lived at home, of course. In those days, you didn't leave home until until you were married. Anyway, so I lived at home. And December 7th, I was dating a high school fellow, like a lot of my friends. And funny thing was, we all got proposed the next day. We were all proposed, about 11 of my friends, because the war was on. And that's what I remember most, is that not only were we frightened about the war being on, but also, we were excited because we all were proposed to. And most of us said no. But the parents of the boys wanted the boys to either go away to college or to get married right away or both, you know. So anyway, that's where I was, December the 7th, at home. And was frightened to death because we were all scared to death because of Roosevelt's speech, you know. The day that would live in infamy, you know.
Yes.
So that's where I was.
Okay, so during the war, did you stay in Winston-Salem?
No, I worked at Coyne's all that 41, as I say, 42, mm-hmm. until like the middle of 43, actually. Our family usually went to Myrtle Beach for the summer. So I was supposed to go to Myrtle to open up the house. In Myrtle Beach in those days, they had little cottages on the beach, you know, you could rent them. There was no phone, nothing like that. And you could rent these little houses on the beach, and they were right on the beach, you know. And you could rent them for a month or 2 months, and our family would go there in the summertime. My mother had 9 children, and I'm the oldest. So I had to go. I was supposed to go that year to open the house and get ready for them to come down in 2 weeks. Well, my best friend Louise's mother took the house next door. Anyway, I tried to talk Louise into, you know, maybe not going there, but go some other place for 2 weeks. and I couldn't talk her into it. But anyway, I remembered that, don't forget, in Winston-Salem, since from 41 until 43, we had the ATC in town, which meant air traffic control with the Army. The Army base, Army would come in, and my God, see, the war is terrible, of course, but because of the war, it changed my life, and it changed a lot of lives, the war. Had it not been for that war, I'd probably be living in Winston-Salem like all of my family are right now. But anyway, I digress. But anyway, at that time, I tried to talk my friend Louise into going with me somewhere, because every place I would go, all these New York people and the people that would, officers and the young men that would come to in the store, and their families would look at me and say, what's that girl doing in a town like this? She belongs in New York. And I would hear that over and over and over. Well, in my family, we'd only been as far as Washington, D.C. You know, I didn't know why people, I would hear that 2 and 3 times a day, not like once a week, but you'd hear it all the time. People would say to Mr. Cohen, what's she doing here? She belongs in New York.
Now, had you ever modeled or anything?
Never. I said, and I couldn't understand why people kept telling me to go to New York. And that is the truth, and I couldn't figure it out. But I said to my friend Louise, why don't we go to New York? Well, Louise said no. But anyway, I made a deal. She would cover for me if I went to New York and didn't tell anybody. So
that was pretty bold for those days. Yeah.
And so anyway, I think I remembered I had $422 is all I had, but that was a lot of money. So yes. I was going to go to New York, but she was not to tell anybody. So I told her, I promised I'd be back the weekend before we had to leave there to come back home. So anyway, I gave her my word, and she's my dearest and oldest friend. Well. So I went to the Greyhound bus station and bought a ticket, a round trip ticket, to go to New York. And I remembered it was all day and all night or something, and all day or something. Anyway, I would get to New York, and I had never been to New York. And the Greyhound bus station, still there, is in a strange part of town.
I bet. It
still is. And so I got out of the bus, and the only cards that I had in those days, I was a member of the YWCA in Winston-Salem, and I had my card with me. So I got into the taxi cab, and he went, where to? I said, the YWCA. He said, which one? Well, I said, the closest one. And there are about 20, you know. Anyway, so he took me to the YWCA, and the one on Lexington Avenue. So I went to the door, and they closed at a certain time. They're not allowed to open the doors after a certain time. And I kept ringing the doorbell, and the taxi was waiting. And finally, a woman came to the door, and I said to her, I'm a member of the YWCA, I said, and I must have looked desperate. And she said, well, we don't have any room. You know, you have to come. The sign said 4 o'clock to wait in line if you want to spend the night. Anyway, so she felt sorry, I think. So she said, pay the taxi, like a little girl. Pay the taxi man. So I paid the taxi man, and he left. And she said, now you can stay here one night only. So I stayed one night. It cost me $3.50. So I spent the night at the Y. And the next morning, you could wait in line at 10 o'clock in the morning or at 4 o'clock if you wanted to stay another night. So I was behind this lady in this line. And I've since thought about it, because I really think there are angels in the world. And I think this was my angel. This woman was in front of me, and she had a nurse's uniform on, and people were waiting to sign up at tables to get a room. And she said, turned to me and said, how long do you want to stay? And I said, oh, I'm only going to be in town just another, I've got to leave a certain time, I told her. And she said, oh, I certainly hope I can stay here. If you're a nurse, you can live here, she said. And my boyfriend, and we can get married, we can get married. If I can stay here, we can save all this money. Because I'm at the Barbizon Hotel for Women, and they charge $38 a week, and I can't afford that. And she said, I would like very much to, you know, she said, I'm hoping that I'll get in. I came yesterday, and they didn't have room. And guess what? She was the last one that got the room. So she turned to me and said, listen, would you like to take my room at the Barbizon? So I said, I thought, at that time, I didn't think much about it, just thought everything happened that way. But since then, I've got a feeling that that was meant to be. And anyway, we came back, we got into a taxi, and I didn't know where the Barbizon was, but we go up there, and it's the Barbizon Hotel for Women only, a beautiful hotel at 63rd and Lex. So,
63rd and Lexington.
Lexington Avenue. So I said, she said, oh, now you need a reference, she said, of someone who lives in the city. I said, oh, Lord, I said, I don't know anybody who lives in the city. She said, well, I can give you this reference. She wrote one down. But now I'm going to go in and tell them that I'm recommending you. Think of somebody, she said, just think of somebody. So I went to the telephone book and took a name and wrote it down. And I don't know whose, but I wrote the name down. And I took her reference and wrote it down on this form that she gave me. And then she had to introduce me to the people. The Barbizon has, they have hotel rooms that are really nice, small, private, and only one floor, the 18th floor for entertaining. Only men can come to, if you have a guest or so forth, you can go to the 18th floor. Anyway, they had little lovely ladies for poured tea every day at 4 o'clock to chaperone everybody. Anyway, so she introduced me to the people, and they took me, and they accepted me with my $38 in advance, and we went upstairs, and she, on the third floor, and the rooms were like the size of maybe a double bathroom, you know, kind of thing. Anyway, so she took all of her, you know, clothes and everything in one little bag and everything, and the closet was very tiny, a washstand in there, just a washstand, a single bed, a desk, and a chair. It was in this little room. Anyway, so that was the room that I was given for the Barbizon at the Barbizon Hotel. If you walked out the room and walked to the right, the showers were at the other end of the room, into the hallway, and or the bathtubs were there. And at the extreme end was the toilets. So everything was, all you had in your room was a wash basin.
Sounds like the dormitories I lived in college.
Yep, absolutely, and a telephone, of course.
So we didn't have telephones in college. Yeah,
so that was my first night in New York. So, and I, of course, then, of course, all the girls on the floor came in to find out who I am and everything. And the next morning, they wanted to know, why did you lock? Next morning was chaotic. Next morning, I kept hearing people running down the hallway. And I couldn't I didn't know what this noise was. So I opened the door. And at home in North Carolina, I'd never seen anyone with no clothes on. No, I just never had seen anybody with no clothes. I had two brothers, and my mother made us wear slips and that kind of thing. We never, never, never saw, even we didn't even see each other with no clothes. And my first morning in New York, I saw dozens of women running down the hall with no clothes on. And I thought, oh, God, where am I? I went back in and sat down and cried. Where am I with all these people? And I knew where they were going, but I had never seen all these people running down the hall with no clothes. That was, I thought, oh, God, I'm in hell. I just figured I was in hell. Oh, Lord. And it was just awful. I remember that to this day, how shocked I was. So that's how.
So then you got a job modeling?
No, I didn't. Not then. I went out that morning. The girls came in and said, well, listen, you don't have to lock your, don't have to close your doors. We don't close our doors. So that was the first thing. And then where are you from and the whole thing. And then they went on to most of them were taking photography classes. We had Catherine Gibbs School, secretarial school in the building. So a lot of them were in secretarial school. A lot of them worked for production companies in New York. A lot of them were secretaries. Most of them were in school here or there. Anyway, and I, so that day, I remembered getting on a bus going straight down Lexington Avenue as far as I could and getting on a bus coming back to see what it was all about. Then I did it on all the avenues to see what's going on. That's the way I learned about New York. And about the second or third day, I sort of had my bearings. But then the girls, listen, you don't want to go home. You have to try out with Powers. What is Powers? You have to try out. He only sees people on Wednesday. So, and the thing was,
This is John Powers, the modeling agency.
Yeah, the modeling agency. And he only sees people on Wednesday. So you've got to go while you're here. Well, it sounded so good and it sounded so interesting, but I said, well, what do they do? Well, they went on and on and on. So these girls educated me in about two or three days, you know. So finally, the second Wednesday, I'd been there several days and they kept telling me what I should do. So anyway, I went, because several girls had been turned down, and these were lovely girls on the floor, and they were very unhappy because their parents sent them there with the intention of them getting a job, you know, and they wanted to model. Anyway, so I went to Powers that morning, that Wednesday morning, and you waited in line again in a big bench outside his office, and the nicest girls, a lot of girls, and then the big windows with nine people on phones who did all the bookings. Anyway, it came my turn, I went in, and he said, now mind you, we're talking June now, because in June in New York, it's hot. And I'm wearing a little cotton Paul Saks design dress, a little cotton dress. And I went in and with high heel shoes. He said, take a walk across the floor. And I did, and she said, where are you from? I told him. He said, now listen, we have a modeling school here, he said. And it's not expensive. It's only $600 a month or something, he said. Now, if you want to start, we're going to start a new class in 2 weeks. If you want to take, and then after you take the class, you can maybe get a job with us. Well, it depends on how you work, how it works out. And I said, to tell you the truth, I have to be home. I'm supposed to be home next week. I only have, you know, a few more days, so I can't really do that, number one. Number two, I don't have the money for a school. And so there, that ends that, and I got up to leave. And he said, listen, he called Helen Ash, who was head of the booking. He said, send this girl over to Pagano Studios and have her have some test shots done. So they told me where to go, and I went over to this place, not too far from the hotel. And they did test shots that afternoon, and then he told me to come back in 2 days. And that was one day before I was to leave. So I came back in 2 days, and he showed me the test shots, and he said, he gave me this beautiful big black shiny hat box, which was a signature for the models to have, and only models can have a hat box like a patent other hat box. It was a big deal, said John Robert Powers. He said, now listen, we will call you and let you know where to go to try out. In the meantime, take these pictures. He already had hundreds of them made of three shots. In this building alone, you have 300 photographers. In this building alone, it's at 246 Park Avenue. He said, now go, even rain or shine, go at least 10 a day. Leave your picture, and they'll call us if they need someone like you. Well, I hit just about all of them in the next day. You know, I just went to all of them and left pictures. And I couldn't figure it out because thousands of pictures are on the walls there of all these places. So I did that. Anyway, the second day, I think, they got this call. I was to model for some dentist. They were promoting a new dental chair. And I'm to be the nurse and the whole thing. And I'm to show up the day I'm supposed to leave. Anyway, so then I had to go home and call my friend's mother, Louise's mother, to find out if she knew anybody at Myrtle to speak to Louise. So Louise's mother found out before my mother where I was. Then she called my mother. So that was chaotic. Anyway, it was terrible. And I had to say to my mother, I've decided to stay in New York. And she said, you go, that is ridiculous.
she didn't call you a hussy?
No, not yet. She said, that is totally ridiculous. She said, you go right now, get out of there. You don't, I don't still don't know why she said, you don't belong up there with all of those people. So come home. And she said, I'm going to send you a ticket. I want you to come home, she said to me. Give me that address. I gave her the address. And then I said, oops, I've got a return on the Greyhound. So I took the return ticket to the Greyhound station and got my money back. But in those days, they give you your money back. So I had that money for another week or something. Anyway, to last me, because I was running short of money. Don't forget, I had $422 to start. Anyway, my mother's ticket came. My mother sent me a ticket to come home.
That's another week of rent money.
That was more money. So at least I had a chance to use her money, you know. So then my mother got angry, wouldn't speak to me. Anyway, so that's how I happened to be there. Now my friend, poor Louise, I had to talk to her, and she felt she was in a doghouse for covering for me. But we got over all that. But anyway, the biggest, worst thing that happened was you get booked, and then the photographer doesn't pay you. The photographer pays Powers. Then Powers takes his 10% and sends you the rest, and all of that takes 30 to 60 days. Well, it was terrible. So, again, I got on the phone with my friend Louise, who forgave me and mailed me $200. To loan me $200 so I could stay in New York. And I remembered having afternoon tea at 4 o'clock. And then I found out the girls cheated. They had milk. They would get milk the night before and hope that it didn't get bad. And they would have cornflakes for breakfast. And then at lunch, and then we would have afternoon tea for lunch at 4 o'clock. And then for dinner, we'd have a chocolate bar or something like that. And then suddenly, all these girls were needing extra dates, a blind date or something. So you go out with these totally strange people to have dinner because it was a nice evening out. And in those days, it was wonderful and everything because you date somebody you know you'd never see again because they're going overseas, you know. So you date them, and the guys were wonderful, and they knew that they could hold your hand, but that's as far as they could go. They just didn't do what they do today. So anyway, that's what happened and how I survived the first few months in New York.
Okay, so you were in New York then for the last couple of years of the war.
Yeah.
I gathered that other than the fact that you had all these guys that wanted to go out and they were being shipped overseas, the war didn't have much impact on your life.
Well, I tell you, the war made my life, honestly. It was like I was enjoying the fact that the war was on. On the other hand, it was chaotic because you listened to your president who told the ladies to be kind and good and write to every fellow they meet. And we all listened to the president. And we all wrote hundreds and hundreds of letters to John and Tom and Harry and everybody. And you'd know where they are, but you'd forget because they're people you just met. And then they had the wonderful churches would do dances and that kind of thing to entertain the men who were in town. If any relatives had people coming through to New York, they'd call and let you know from home, you know, so-and-so's in New York. So you'd see everybody. You got really busy meeting everybody, and it was an exciting time for me, you know. Working during the day, I had to get to bed early, though, because you get a booking at 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning. It may last all day. But anyway, my job came first. I survived. My job came first. And the guys would say, where would you like to go for dinner? Oh, well, Lindy's, maybe for dinner. And then maybe to a nightclub, to the Stork Club, maybe, or someplace. Oh, would you like to see like to go to the theater? Oh, yes. I saw Oklahoma about 20 times the first year there, and the tickets were hard to get. But I would... So I saw New York in a way that other people wouldn't have seen New York. So I enjoyed the war, I must say.
Then eventually you decided that you wanted to try out to join the USO.
No. Oh. No, that was a big contest they had. Powers had a contest where it was mandatory. We all had to try out.
I
At that time I was doing a movie. They chose me for a movie with Beatrice Lilly.
Wow.
And it was called the British American Serviceman's Canteen with Beatrice Lilly. So I was then doing a movie. At that time then, I was also doing fashion shows for all the designers on Broadway. And 1400 Broadway, where I later ended up. But all the designers were doing 2 and 3 shows a year. So we would model for them. We did not only modeling, runway modeling, but the Toby Coburn big fashion show they did at the Waldorf twice a year. And when I went to do that, they just send you out. You know, the girls taking the bookings don't know your ability. They just send everybody out. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they had me in a fashion show. I'd never been in a fashion show, but they... They put me in this fashion show, and it fitted. Everything was fitted and everything fine at the Waldorf. Well, I happened to see this long 500-foot runway, and I thought, oh, good God, and I'd never been on a runway before. But all you do is copy somebody else. So that's what I did. So I got away with that. Anyway, I must have done pretty well. So I was making a lot of money. Suddenly, I made a lot of money, and I did the movie. And around the time I did the movie, the thing came up with, I did the 2 covers. I did Today's Woman cover, and then I did Charm magazine cover, and a lot of colored shots inside. Then the big, on the wall was this, at Powers, was this big sign that said it's mandatory that you go to the Waldorf Astoria on a Monday at 4:00. Budweiser Bush sponsored the they took the room, I gather, and they said sponsored by Anheuser-Busch, and they wanted to organize a USO troop. They wanted to book it the most beautiful girls in the world, and all the papers wrote it all up about John Robert Powers models choosing the most beautiful women to go overseas with Jimmy Durante to appear in a troop show called the Copacabana Review, and Monty Proser, who owned a Copa, was going to be one of the judges, and they were going to choose 7 or 8 girls to go to be part of the troop.
And how many girls were there competing?
There were 400 girls from Powers that competed, and every Monday they eliminated 75 to 100, and the contest was to run 6 weeks.
So this was at the beginning of 1945.
It started February. Uh-huh. Started in February, Valentine's week of 1945. Anyway, so every Monday you had to go. No matter where you were, at 4:00, you had to get away to go to the Waldorf. Take about a half hour to walk down the runway. We'd wait in line to walk down a runway, and every Monday, all these girls were eliminated. It only showed the women that were left on the wall at Powers. It showed the women that were left. And every Monday we'd look and we were left. So every Monday if your name was up there, you had to go. So every Monday we went. And I had no idea that I would be chosen because I'd fallen in love with a nice guy who was at Sheepshead Bay. He was stationed at Sheepshead Bay in the Maritime Service in Brooklyn. And he was from Brooklyn. And I thought, oh, heavens, this is the wrong time. And meanwhile, I never dreamed I'd be chosen. And I didn't really need to be chosen because I was doing very well where I was. But anyway, we had to do this. But at the very end, every Monday we went, and at the very end, the last Monday, my name was on the board. Now, that meant we had to sign up for a six-month contract with USO, and they would do training from February until May when we left. But we had to train for a show to back Jimmy Durante, which we had to wear very pretty fashions. Unlike Vegas, we actually were showgirls, you would call it, but we wore clothing, you know. But we had to back Jimmy Durante, who did his shenanigans, you know, and with Hal McIntyre's orchestra, which was a big name in those days. Hal McIntyre's orchestra went with us, and a wardrobe manager and the mistress, and then we had to be fitted for our uniforms. Saks Fifth Avenue did all the USO uniform
wow.
designs, so we had to be fitted there. We had to go to Staten Island to be trained how to shampoo your hair out of a helmet, how to put on a gas mask, and how to all those things, and what kind and what They showed us what kind of food you had to eat and the K rations kind of thing. So we went through all of that, and then we had to practice. Had to go to the Waldorf to practice for the show. And then they had in the show they had a ballerina, they had a trio, a singing female trio, and the eight powers models, which were called the most beautiful girls in the world. Anyway, then they had a singer, Julie Wilson, who was a singer, who Julie was singing at, even like 2 years ago, I caught Julie Wilson still singing at the La Maisonette on Fifth Avenue.
Wow.
She's still singing. Anyway, that's Julie Wilson, famous. She was in Kiss Me, Kate. Mm-hmm. She came back. She was in Kiss Me, Kate and several other musicals. But anyway, so we...
We were trained.
We had to practice from February until May. And also in those days, it was very, everything was hush hush. We were not allowed to tell. Number one, we didn't know whether we were going to go to the Pacific or to the Atlantic. We did not know which ocean we'd cross. And we had to be very careful. All of your phones were monitored. We were not allowed to make any calls from the day we signed that contract. Hmm. We could write letters, but even we were not allowed to tell anybody. It was amazing. It was amazing in those days how secure everything was.
Helene, you were talked about your training for the USO and how that you were monitored and everything like that. So finally they do tell you and you do ship out. Now, where did you go and how did you get there?
But they told us, like, they only gave you 1 day notice, but we were prepared for that. They told you, they said, we will give you 1 day notice and you're not allowed to tell anybody. You're not allowed. You have to come to New York City. They gave us the pier number. And you come there. When we went there, we did not know. Don't forget, this is in May. And if you remember correctly, in April, the war was over in Europe. One week after the war was over. War was over in May 1945. Mm-hmm. And in 1948, Roosevelt died. The same month.
1945,
yeah. Roosevelt died. In 1945, April 1945, also, Hitler committed suicide in 1945. And in April. And a few weeks after Hitler committed suicide is when the war ended in Europe.
Yeah, the war, I think, officially ends in June.
We sailed the middle of May 1945. We sailed, and we were the first ship that went out of New York Harbor with our lights on. The lights were off on every ship except ours. The lights went on. They had the USAT Excelsior was our ship, and that ship was full of soldiers going over to clean up the mess that we had made, what they called, I don't know, their cleanup brigade or something. All these soldiers were to go there. So the people who'd been over there, who had been working in Europe and in the services, could be shipped to the Pacific, either shipped to the Pacific or they could come home. So they sent new soldiers over on our ship. So we rehearsed every night on board to entertain them. We did our rehearsal of the show going over. And we didn't know until we were on board which way we were going to go. But luckily we were happy we were going to Europe. And they put there was a ship ahead of us doing what they called mine sweeping the ocean. Uh-huh. Ahead of us. But our lights were at least on going across. So we went to Le Havre, and headquarters.
Le Havre in France.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And the headquarters were in Paris, were the headquarters. And we were there for 2 weeks, rehearsing there, waiting for them to get the caravan ready. They have to have trucks for the supplies and for the costumes. And then we had jeeps and weapons carriers. We sat in weapons carriers with the canvas tops, with the benches along each side. That's how we traveled. Or we traveled sitting next to people in jeeps traveling all over France and Germany. And we had a chance to see some of Paris for the few days we were there, in between the rehearsals. Mickey Rooney's group were there. We had Jane Froman, who was there. You know Jane Froman, uh-huh. who from her background, she was the one that was, her plane went down over the channel, and her captain of the plane saved her, and she later married him. But anyway, that's a lovely movie that they did on her. But she was, at the time we met her, she was having her 27th operation from her big plight. But she still entertained after that. And she entertained in pain. She entertained in beautiful fashions. They built a stage for her and had a way for her to stand up, you couldn't see, so that she could still entertain, because she loved entertaining. So we met her while they were doing all, they were trying to prepare her and get her well enough to entertain again. We met Frances Langford and Andrew's sisters, all the people that you hear mm-hmm. about. We met them all there at the Paris, at the headquarters there. And when you go in there, you don't come back to the Paris headquarters until you're ready to ship back home mm-hmm. again. So we didn't get back there until fall. We came back the first week in November to Paris.
What was your impression of Paris and Europe? What did you see and observe?
Well, in Paris, when we were there, there was still a lot of damage, a lot of stuff going on. We people were trying to repair and build up and clean up, but all through France, there was a lot of damage. It was nothing like going into Germany, because we were the first USO group people going into Germany, because right after the war, don't forget. We were the first ones going in, and you had the Hitler Youth kids that were still trying to play all kind of games, where we had to put bayonets in front of our jeeps to cut piano wire they strung across highways
wow.
and roads, because they were causing any kind of havoc. It was chaotic then. They had chosen every two girls. They had a soldier with each. Every two girls had a soldier that stayed with us at all times, that carried guns, you know, that stayed with us from the time we left Paris until we came back. Wherever we would go, you had to have protection wherever you would go. We entertained in the fields. By the time we got to a place, they called these places dust bowls. They were people, the officers and the enlisted men would live in tents all over, out in big open fields. And the shows, they would build these wooden platforms, and that's where the shows were held. And wooden platforms, usually right before dark. And they would try to have the show over by dark, so it would cut down on lighting and that kind of thing. So you walk out in the field, and they have the curtains around a dressing room area. You did the shows outdoors, and you look out and see 10,000 of men sitting on the ground all the way around you. That's where you did the shows. You know, it wasn't fancy or anything. And but then going into these towns in Germany, it's very strange now when you think about it. You would tell the officers that traveled with us, they would say to us, which house would you like to live in? Like to live in two nights. We'd be there only two nights. And we'd point at a beautiful house, and they would walk in and give the German families 2 hours to leave.
Wow.
And that's exactly what happened. And then the German people would leave in 2 hours. They would dig holes in the backyard, and they would bury all of their silver and bury everything in the backyard and try to cover it up. And we would come in for 2 days and live in these big houses. They took care of the women first. We live in these lovely homes, and they'd take the next house. They'd take 3 or 4 houses for 2 nights. And then we would come in, and after a few days, we would sort of know, you see what they've hidden. So we would take the silver, and then we'd all wash the silver and enjoy our dinner, make dinner and have a good dinner. But before we left, we put it back. So I remember that to this day. But we enjoyed living that way. And in funny, and all over in France, you had Roosevelt's picture in all these houses that they took over. And when you get to Germany, you had Hitler's picture in every room you would see. Every room had Hitler's pictures, big and small, all over these places. steel in Germany, you know. So that was
You didn't really get to meet the population,
not
though,
at all. Not at all. Not at all. We simply went in, and you're protected, and you weren't allowed to go. You weren't allowed to do anything except just be together and check into these places to live. And you weren't. We certainly couldn't shop. You couldn't go around. It was very dangerous to get around. You had to stay in a group, stay together, and then do your show, and then we packed to leave the next day.
Did you feel scared or threatened?
No, because you don't. Funny thing is, when you're young, you just don't get scared. And they kept the attitude, the pitch. It was pitched high, and people were happy, and we all got along very well. You know, people got along well, and it was really nice. You knew that there was danger because they protected you so much. That's the only thing you realized, that you couldn't go any place, you couldn't have any privacy at all, because it was just a togetherness at all times. I remembered one time, the one thing you miss a lot, I think, in traveling, certainly like that. You have K rations, of course, and they would prepare dinners. And when you take these houses over, we'd all get together and cook because you had no one else doing it. So we would cook and make good food, and the officers would find food for you downtown or wherever they shop for you. You'd have plenty of food. But what you missed most was fruit. And I remembered one day in Germany, we passed this house, and I saw this beautiful apple tree. And so I slipped out before dark, I slipped out, and I knew they were all doing whatever they were doing. Anyway, I got out there, and I climbed the apple tree, and I got some apples and put them in my pocket and everything, and I took my helmet to carry apples back and everything, and suddenly I heard three or four military police came along, "Stay where you are, don't move." So I didn't move, and they said the fields hadn't been demined.
Oh.
And so they had to stay up there about an hour until they got through with their little thing on the ground to see if they could find any treasures, I guess. But anyway, I tipped and toed out of there, but that was the only danger I was ever in. I got out of it, but I had a beautiful helmet full of apples, you know, which you miss the apples. You miss fruit, I think, more than anything else. That's about as dangerous as it got, you know, for me. But then we did all of the interesting places, like the Remagen Bridge. We read about in the papers how the Germans were trying to... the Americans were trying to cross over the Remagen Bridge. We were in Remagen, the town of Remagen, and we went down all the way down to Bavaria and to Salzburg. We did all of that area through there. But I thought the thing was, the Germans still hated us. You could tell on the streets they would spit at you, you know, and at the caravan if they came along. We had about 20 cars coming, trucks and cars, all traveling together. And, of course, by that time, they probably knew what was happening, you know, because they'd all gather, the officers and the enlisted men would all gather in this big field, and we did our shows in the big field, except in Salzburg. We had the theater. We had a big theater there. In Bavaria, we had theater. So big cities, we could have the big theaters they took over. And the thing is, it's amazing how they just, I think it's amazing how you just walk in and tell people, "You have 3 hours." And we don't know where they went. I often wonder, where did they go in 3 hours?
Stayed with relatives, I imagine.
It was two nights. Yeah. It was like we would take over for two nights. Every place would be two nights. And we'd do two shows and you'd get out again, you know? But that's sort of what happened all over Germany.
So you were there throughout the rest of 1945?
We went to France. We did France. We did Cannes. We got back to... then we came back to Paris, and out of Paris, we came back home from Le Havre again.
Uh-huh. So you were home by...
November 1st. We got back to the States November the 1st.
Okay, and then you went on to a very successful career
I went back to modeling again, and then I went to a fashion institute. I was always interested in learning something about fashions and everything. So I went to Trapagan School of Design there in New York for a course in design. And I studied that while I was in. The money we made. We made $600 a week being with USO. They paid $600 a week. And the money had to go.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
It was a lot of money then. And the money had to go into a bank in New York, and you had to put someone else's name on it. And so I thought, whose name would I put on it? And I thought, well, my baby sister, Sunny, was just born. She was like, you know, about 3 years old. Anyway, I put Sunny's name on it in case I didn't come back. You know, it was so funny. So I told Sunny later, but I never knew that, she said. But we made $600 a week. So by the time I came back, we had a lot of money in the bank. And I thought, well, I'll maybe do something and sign up for this course. You know, it was like a 6-month course at Trapagan. So I did that. I signed up for that. And I met my boyfriend, of course, when I came back. And we got married. And so it was wonderful. The money came in handy. It was a good thing I did, you know. And then shortly after I got married, I got pregnant. And then looking around for clothes to wear, at the time designing too, you go into the stores. In those days, anybody who was pregnant in 1946, let me tell you something. If you walked into a department store, they would have, in the bridal department, behind, they have a closet with a curtain across the front of it, like it's something you don't look at.
Taboo. Yeah.
They had black dresses and navy blue dresses. They had little white collars and little white cuffs. They had elastic at the waistline, and that is what you wore, because you didn't go out when you began to show. You just don't go anywhere when you begin to show. You stayed home where you belonged when you were pregnant. And only until you started showing could you wear these elastic things, you know. Well, no way would I wear that kind of thing. So I made my own clothes. And one time going into one of the bigger stores, I've forgotten whether it was which designer. I think it was Cecil Chapman. I was doing the Cecil Chapman show one time when... And I was just early in my early pregnancy, and I was in the elevator, and I was wearing this lovely two-piece outfit that I had worn. It looked very chic. And a woman in there said, "What? That's a darling dress," she said. "Where did you get it?" And I said, "I made it." And she said, "You made it?" She said, it would make a nice maternity dress." She said, I said, "Oh, you know, because it's what I was trying to hide everything." And she said, "It's really nice, you know." And so later, after the show, I saw her in the elevator, and I said, "Tell me about maternity. She was from Filene's in Boston. And I said, "What kind of maternity clothes do you have?" She said, "Well, we only have one-piece dresses." And I said, "The black and the navy, yes." And I said, "Well, I'm thinking of doing some maternity things." And she said, "Are you pregnant?" "Yes." And she said, "Oh, I'd be interested in seeing, you know." Again, another angel, I tell you, my second angel in the world. And so I've showed her two or three things that I had made. And she said, and now, apropos of that, my husband, who was a professional swimmer, he was understudy to Weissmuller.
Oh, wow.
Johnny Weissmuller and Buster Crabbe during the World's Fair in 1939. Anyway, my husband at that time had gotten out of service, and his father manufactured house dresses, basement kind of house dresses that you wore, like little ladies wore every morning, like little house dresses. And he had been manufacturing for all of his life. So there I had somebody who knew something about something, factories certainly. So I made three styles up that I had worn. And I showed them to the lady at Filene's. And she loved them and bought the three styles. My father-in-law made them, shipped them to her. And the following year, I put out a whole collection of maternity clothes. I did evening clothes. I did separates. I did ladies' slacks. I did pedal pushers.
Wow.
I did swimsuit. I did everything in maternity that people should have. And I didn't know any better. I took the Grand Ballroom at the New Yorker Hotel and showed my fashions to people I'd never heard of. I sent invitations to all the buyers that bought maternity to come and look at my come and look at my maternity clothes, and they'd never heard of such a thing that anybody would dare show maternity clothes, right? And I had my model friends model them for me, and my husband had to moderate the show, and my husband never always had trouble saying the different color or color. The color is red, or the collar is a high collar, right? So between the color and the collar, we got through it, you know. But anyway, he moderated the show. He loved it because all the pretty girls were wearing the clothes, you know. So we did this wonderful fashion show, and everybody bought. And when everybody buys the same fashions, I had 18 fashions in the show, and we actually cut 14 out of 18, which is unheard of, which means cutting. You don't cut unless you get 10 or 20,000 in order. You don't dare buy the fabric to cut, you know. So anyway, we did that.
So you revolutionized the maternity.
And then the stores all wanted after that. They wanted not only the maternity, but they wanted you to come and do a trunk showing, which I did. So for 20 years, twice a year, every April and every September, I traveled 6 weeks in the spring and 6 weeks in the fall to promote my maternity, which became a national trade name, Helene Scott Maternity.
Uh-huh.
So that's...
Wow.
That was my maternity thing.
So how, in God's name, did you get from New York to Amelia Island?
Oh, boy. That's another story in New York. Well, I stayed there. I was in New York when my kids went to college. My daughter and my son went to college, went to Berkeley in California. And then my daughter became an attorney, and my son became a stockbroker. He lives in Aspen, Colorado. His name is Bob, and my daughter Star is a lawyer. She's in India at the moment, and she's doing the editing all of Swami Chidananda's, all of his lectures of the past 50 years. He just died last month, and she's editing all of his lectures for him. Anyway, that's my daughter. And I lived in New York all those years until my kids went away to college. When they decided to go to college, I decided to travel. And then I traveled for a while. After I retired from maternity business 20 years later. Then I decided to travel and then decided I'd become, since I like traveling, I didn't have kids at home, I got a job as a social director on the MS Victoria cruise ship out of New York City. It went to the Mediterranean Black Sea. And so I did that for 2 years. And then from there I went to Norwegian Caribbean down in Florida and became the first woman cruise director, because all the men did those jobs in those days. And I took that on for 7 years. And then my kids got married, and my daughter had two little children, and then I decided to help her raise her two children, and now one is a nurse in L.A. Mari is a nurse in L.A. taking her master's, and she also has a she has a band of five girls who play drums only. It's a drumming thing, and they just entertained at the Getty Museum.
Oh,
so. And then my other granddaughter, Luna, my Star's daughter, Luna, just gave birth in January this year to her baby.
So now you're a great-grandma.
Now I'm a great-grandma. Yeah. And she is, her name is Magnolia, and she is exactly 8 months old and learning to crawl. And she wants to see the world and see what's going on around there. She can't wait to walk. She's 8 months old and doing it all.
So how did you get here?
Oh, so then I went down while Mari was in nursing school. My granddaughter was in nursing school in Key West. Did you know they have a nursing school in Key West?
No.
Well, they have. They have a nursing school in Key West, and Mari was in nursing school. And, of course, my daughter being in India, I decided to go to Key West and keep an eye on Mari. And so I was there, and I love Key West. But then when she moved to L.A., I decided, where would I like to live, you know? And I heard about Amelia Island because my son owned a property here on 6th Street. And next to June, who has the June Nash next to that beautiful house where she decorates by seasons. Mm-hmm. She does her decorating. My son owned the house next to her. The Goldmans own it now. and Lou Goldman and his wife. Anyway, my son owned that house. So anyway, I moved here because I loved Fernandina, and I loved trees. The trees brought me here. Mm-hmm. And I bought the house on Blue Heron Lane because of the lovely trees. Mm-hmm. So that's what brought me here.
And you still keep very active and vital.
Well, I was all right for about a year. I took it easy, and then I figured out that they didn't have a Democratic club in Fernandina, and I decided, well, we had to do something about that. So I started the Democratic club, which now we meet once a month at St. Peter's, and we're now working hard for Obama, Biden, of course, and so that's been going nicely. We're on our sixth president. Our first president was Gail Howard. The second was Charles Albert. And the third president was Paul Watford. After Paul was Joan Cipriano, then Deborah Sullivan, and now we have Joyce Frink, mm-hmm. who are presidents of the Democratic Club. The Democratic Club of Amelia Island for Men and Women is called. Men and women. Oh, God.
Well, you've really lived a fascinating life. This concludes our interview. And so I want to thank you, Helene, very much for sharing your recollections with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, but I want one more thing.
Okay.
One more thing I did two and a half years ago. It'll be 3 years this November. I started a club for older people.
Oh, yes.
Called Just Friends. People who are single, over age 55. I put an ad in the paper that said, are you old enough? You must be over age 55 and single to join Just Friends, which meant that for people who move here, and a lot of people move here from other places, they have no way of meeting other people, their age level. And I had heard that over and over again, so I started this club. Now, it's free to join. It's not a business. It's a simple thing. All you do is call me, give me your name, address, and phone number. Tell me you're over age 55, and you get a personal invitation every month to come to lunch or dinner, and you get introduced to everybody in the room the old-fashioned way, face-to-face. So that's what we're doing now. I have 277 names.
Wow.
I have 277 people I send invitations to every month, and we're growing. And we had, in August this year, our first marriage. Jean Botts, who moved here from Arizona, came to one party, and he met Dot Soddard. And she had been coming to about six parties before that, about her sixth one. And he met her the first night, and they've been together ever since. And we had that party at Miss Carolyn's for breakfast. Uh-huh. Miss Carolyn's,
right?
And
I know. Miss
we
Carolyn's.
Had dinner. We had breakfast for dinner at 6 o'clock, and that's where they met. And they got married in August this year.
Well,
so isn't that nice?
Yes,
but
is.
When they start dating and start going out together,
they can't. Yeah.
They can't come anymore.
Right.
They can't come to my parties anymore. And I keep saying, but don't let that stop you. You know. But they still keep in touch.
Well, thank you very much. And this concludes our interview with Helene Scott.